We're going to take a jump and do a 30,000 foot level study of Job. Everybody's got a job, right? It's interesting how you can call that Job when we got, there's no E there, but that's the way it's pronounced. Must be a Jewish thing, a Hebrew thing. Like I've said before, I know nothing of Hebrew, so you could tell me anything about Hebrew and I'd believe you because I know nothing. But I wanted to take a look at Job and do a 30,000 foot level study on it because it would take forever for us to get through it if we were to do it verse by verse and chapter by chapter. And since I only have 1 hour and to do this, it's easier to just kind of delve in a little bit and then pull out and look at things and then delve in maybe towards the end. So we're going to kind of sandwich the study a little bit. So a little bit about Job, the book of Job. The author and the date are unknown. The author does not credit himself for the book. And so wherever the Bible is silent, we are not necessarily silent. We always like to guess and take a gander at what is meant in between the lines. But realistically, if you're a true student of the Bible, wherever the Bible is silent, we also should be silent. Because when the Bible is silent on something, it means that it's not that important. But, you know, we like to try to figure it out anyway, you know, as if we know the mind of God. But there are some guesses. Some of them guess that it's Job himself. Some of them guess it's Solomon. And some of them have guessed it's Moses. And in the science of particle theory, the answer is yes. How many of you guys have studied quantum theory? It's a fascinating subject. The answer is, no matter what the question is, the answer is always yes. And so since we don't know who the author is, we also don't know what the date that the book was written. There are some speculations since he's taken things out of Proverbs and he's taken things out of Psalms, and it's during the patriarchal period of the dispensation. They're guessing anywhere between 587 to 538 BC. It's a very old book, probably the first ones written for, out of the prophetic prophet books. And so that's the statistics. The original meaning of the word Job has been lost, but of course that doesn't mean anything to Bible scholars. They like to guess anyway, and it's based on the more current Hebrew language, and you know they're guessing that it can mean my enemy or where is my father. So anywhere in between those two is good for the grabbing. So, and, but it's interesting how in the Hebrew culture that they take a significant value of the name and its meaning. They seem to always put a lot of weight on the meaning of the name, where in English, you know, in American, we just throw out names like, I'm Dennis the Menace, which means I'm a menace to society. But that doesn't really mean anything, you know, it's just kind of fun in American. But in Hebrew culture, they take names very seriously. So that's the reason why when you do biblical studies in the Old Testament, they always try to find the meaning of the name. And a lot of times the Bible will give you that meaning. In this instance, it hasn't, but they try to guess. So there are some really important things theologically that we can glean out of the book of Job, and that's the reason that I decided to choose it. I kind of wish I had a little bit more time to prepare for it, but we'll just grab what I was able to get under the circumstances. A brief outline of the book is the first part is Job's character and his circumstances and the test, and that's from verse 1, chapter 1, verse 1 to chapter 2, verse 13. And then there's the dialogue about Job, his suffering, and his standing before God. And then, of course, the famous dialogue with his wife and his friends. And, you know, you get the famous quote from his wife, you know, just curse God and die, will you? Let's get this over with. You know, a real loving, compassionate woman that he's got there. And then you have the power of God, the place of wisdom, the path of integrity, suffering as a way of discipline, and that is accusatory from his friends that the reason that he's suffering is because he's done wrong in the sight of God somewhere, somehow. You know, and back then, anytime anybody had serious illness or suffering or catastrophe in their life, they seen it as a judgment of God on them because they obviously did something very bad. And we kind of carry that over even today, don't we, just to some extent. When you see someone that's going through a horrific time, we look at them and go, well, what in the heck did you do to deserve all of that? And we see in Job that isn't necessarily the case, is it? But and then the third part, we have the vindication, intercession, and restoration of God. So first I'd like to take some things out of chapter 1 and chapter 2. And the first thing we want to see is an introduction to Job and what kind of character, what kind of person was Job. In chapter 1, verse 1, who would like to read 1 through 3. Chapter 1, verse 1 through 3. Go ahead. Thank you. So what kind of man was Job? Pardon? Wealthy? Blameless is easier to spell. What other attributes can we find about Job in there? Perfect. Now, the Bible likes to use the word perfect a lot, and it's sometimes we get confused in the meaning of that word, the English word translation. When you hear the word perfect, what comes to your mind? What attributes do you, that comes to your mind when you hear perfect? The first word that comes out of your mouth is Dennis, right? Bonnie. Complete, right. So, in the Hebrew translation, we get more of a sense of completeness. Job was a complete person, kind of sold out to God. We can kind of read between the lines here that Job was sold out to God. In our vocabulary, when you hear perfect, we always think of sinless, you know. And that's not the case, you know. We don't know that what kind of sins Job committed, but we do read, you know, later on in this chapter that his sons would hold a party, a feast, and they would take turns going to each other's house and drink wine, and they invite their sisters over, and they throw a party. And after the party was over, Job would go out and make a sacrifice for his family just in case they blaspheme God in the process of too much wine. So, you know, it doesn't say specifically that Job himself sinned, but he is aware of sin and breaking relationship with God and blaspheming him and the need for a sacrifice. And he, you know, probably more often than not, you know, sacrificed for his own sins as well. So we're not saying that Job was sinless, but he was sold out. In the same way that David was a man after God's own heart, right? Was David sinless? I don't think so. But he did have a heart for God. And he always repented when he was confronted with his sin or realized his sin. And it was probably the same way with Job. It doesn't go into detail on that, but, you know, we can probably safely say he wasn't perfect, but he was another man after God's own heart, right? He was perfect in that sense. In he feared God and avoided evil. That is pretty phenomenal. It tells us right there, kind of, to avoid evil, we first must fear God. Because if you don't fear God, when what does fear mean? Does that mean go trembling and afraid he's going to strike you with a lightning bolt at any time? A reverent fear, that's right. Job had great humbleness and respect of God. And it was that humbleness and that respect that he was able to develop the close relationship he had with God. And in that close relationship, the more he learned about God and knew about God, the easier it was for him to avoid evil. Any questions on that? Is that clear as mud? So that, you know, I want to take us back up a little bit as a parenthesis, okay? Whenever we go into the Old Testament, we're in a different dispensation. What does a dispensation mean? An era. It is how God related to man, right? In the dispensation of law, in order for man to relate to God, man had to provide sacrifices for his sins, right? As part of the law. As a covering of the sins, they had to sacrifice an animal and put blood on the altar. In a current dispensation, God no longer requires that of us to have a relationship with him. What does God require of us to have a relationship with him now in this dispensation? Faith in Jesus. That's right. To accept the death, burial, and resurrection of Christ and his atonement of sins on the cross and recognize him as God. And then repenting, right? Repenting means turning around. You know, before we're living for ourselves, and now we're living for God. Those are the ingredients to develop a relationship with God. So I only say that because a lot of times people will go back into the Old Testament and try to make applications to their lives today, and it doesn't apply to us. How God dealt with people in the Old Testament is not how God deals with us today. It's a different dispensation, a different time, and a different relationship. God himself does not change. His personality, his attributes, and who he is does not change throughout the ages. He is the same yesterday, today, and tomorrow of who God is. How he relates to us is what changes. So when we go into the Old Testament, we're not looking for applications in our lives. What we're looking for is learning more about God's attributes, of who he is. That's what we can take from the Old Testament. Any questions or comments on that? I kind of want to make that kind of clear. Because a lot of churches will go back into the Old Testament and try to make those stories applicable to our lives today, and they're not. Okay? Therefore, who was the Old Testament written to? The Jews. They're written to the Jews, and they're written for the Jews, and they're written for that time. So it's not for us to take stories out of the Old Testament and try to apply them to our lives. So we can learn and apply this to our lives because this is who God is. The more we fear him, the easier it is to avoid evil. That is a principle that we can apply because an attribute of God. Okay? So I wanted to get that clear. Okay. So next, we go down to verse 6. And 6 and 7, who would like to read verse 6 and 7? Okay. Let's go a little bit further. Let's go. Perfect. Okay, here's some interesting things. 2. From this verse, what can we learn about the attribute of Satan? Constantly searching, isn't he? Where is he searching? On the earth. What does that imply? He's not in heaven. He's on a mission. He has full reign on earth, right? He's searching to and fro across the earth. He has full reign, seeking whom he may devour, right? So he is not confined to one area. You know, he's not confined in hell, is he? Remember all the cartoons, pictures we have of, you know, Satan? He's got the pointed tail and the pitchfork, and he's stabbing people and throwing them in the fire. That's totally not what he is it? So he is not in hell. He's not even in the lake of fire at the moment. He's not even in Hades at the moment. Where is he? He's on earth. What is another attribute that we can put on him? Right. He has access to heaven, doesn't he? Well, to God. To go before God. And it shows, I find it interesting. It says, now there was a day when the sons of God, who are the sons of God? Angels. Came to present themselves before the Lord. They all have an accountability time when they come before God and they give an account for what they've been doing. And in that crowd of angels, Satan also has to come before God and give an accountability to himself. The first thing God asks him is, where have you come? Where have you been? So even Satan has to give an accountability to God for what he's doing, which means that he is still under the authority of God. So then in verse 8, it's interesting that it says, and the Lord said to the adversary, have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and avoids evil? It's interesting that Satan didn't bring up the subject of Job, that God did. God saw how faithful Job was to him, and God is proud of Job. And he's saying, of all the people that you've been looking for, he says, and you've been, you know, you can find fault with, that man there, you're not able to find fault with. You know, I'm proud of him. He is standing for me, and he's my man. And then it goes on and talks about, Satan says, of course he does. You know, of course he's your man. Look how you blessed him. You know, he's got 7,000 camels and richest man in the world. You know, he's the Bill Gates of us. And it's, you know, no wonder he loves you. Who wouldn't love you with, you know, you blessed him like that? And it's a direct challenge to God, see? And God responds and says, okay, you can have possession of all that he has, but don't touch Job, right? So what are the couple of things we can learn from that is, one, Satan is not allowed to do anything without the permission of God. If he doesn't have the permission of God, he cannot do as he wills. So, go ahead. That's a good question, and I actually thought about that. Do you think that it would just be for believers that he wouldn't have permission? Now, I separate it in here because the first attack is on his possessions. And I believe that can be for everybody. The second part, where he actually is given permission to attack Job himself, with the blisters, I believe that he has to have special permission for believers. And the reason I believe that is because those who are not believers, those who do not follow God, are already in Satan's possession. And he already has freedom of will to do as he pleases with those people because they already belong to him. But he has to have permission to attack God's people. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that kind of gets into our spiritual welfare warfare discussion on Tuesdays, but absolutely. There's a rule that says that Satan can oppress a Christian, but Satan cannot possess a Christian, and for that very reason, because darkness cannot reside in light at the same time. Darkness and light cannot coexist at the same time. So, you know, we are the light of the world, and we do, as Don says, have the Holy Spirit residing in us. So therefore, there's no way that Satan can possess us. And plus, we are sealed by the Holy Spirit. We are God's. The moment that we receive him as our personal Savior, we now belong to him, and there is no way for Satan to possess us. Can he oppress us? Why, sure he can. Get with God's permission. I think that falls in with the last discussion on spiritual warfare that Jesse had, where you open doors. Mm-hmm. you open doors and you invite him. You know, you can do that through seances, Ouija boards, watching occult movies, anything to do with you know, Satan's realm. You show an interest in that. You're kind of opening up a door to be oppressed. And I have seen oppressed Christians. And it's not pleasant. You don't want to go there. Just stay away from that. Okay, so we're going to skip through that and go, you know, through all these chapters. They're trying to figure out why Job has all these problems. You know, his family is killed, his possessions are taken, the armies, you know, invade, he gets boils. I mean, and it's kind of not funny, but I mean, it's like one servant after another comes in and gives a report to Job before the first servant's done, you know. Job, your sons are all dead. Job, your camels are all gone. Job, you got nothing. And the neat response that Job has to all of that bad news, where everything is taken, Satan has taken everything away from him, is he rents his clothes and he worships God and he says, "Naked have I been born, and naked will I die." You know, he does not curse God with all of that. It's awesome. How many of us would be able to do that? I mean, we, you know, losing our children is probably the worst thing that can ever happen to us. And I've seen so many Christians stand up and, you know, "God, how could you allow this to happen? You know, my child was so innocent and young, and you've taken them away from us," and, you know, "Bad God, you're bad," you know, cursing God. But Job didn't take that route. He feared God, and he avoided evil. Okay, and then Job asked God, well, first, Job is like, "Why was I ever born? I am sorry I was ever born," you know, and all this kind of stuff, and kind of challenges God. And then we go to chapter 40. I love this answer God gives Job. Verse 40. And let's go down to verse 6. Let's read 6 through... Well, just... No, let's go further than that. Let's go to 15 through 24. This is God's answer to Job. 15 to 24. Bueller? Okay. Thank you. So he's just giving Job an example of one of the creations that he has done. And he's basically saying, look, Job, can you do that? I not only created this creature, but I protected him, I provided for him, and he has want for nothing. Let me see you do that, okay? And he goes on in chapter 41, he says, can you draw the Lethean with a hook or snare his tongue line which lets you down? Can you put a cord in his nose? And then talks about the Lethean, and then it says, let's see, let's go down to, let's go back where really, let's go back to, let's go back to chapter 39. And we'll start with verse 9. Will the wild ox be willing to serve you or spend the night by your manger? Can you bind the wild ox in the furrow with ropes? Or will he pillow the valleys behind you? Will you trust him because of great strength? And then it goes to 13. Do you give beautiful wings to the peacocks or the wings of the feathers to the ostrich, who leaves her eggs in the earth and worms them out in the dust? Talks about the peacock. And then it says, have you given the horse strength? Have you clothed his neck with thunder? Can you make him afraid like a grasshopper? And then he talks about the horse. And then he says, does the hawk fly by your wisdom? In verse 26. And stretch out its wing towards the south. Does the eagle mount up at your command and make his nest on high? And so in chapter 40, verse 2, he says, will he who argues with him, the Almighty, instruct him? He who rebukes God, let him answer it. And so, you know, bottom line, what is God saying to Job in response to Job's question of why was I born? Who are you to question me? You know, where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? You know, can you measure the circumference? You know, can you number the people? You know, I am God. You know, I like you, man, but you're kind of, you know, out of place here. You're my creation. Why are you questioning me? How do I do things? I am God, your creator, and I do not have to answer to you why I do things. How many of us have questioned God why he's done things to us? I know I have. That's God's answer. He says, you can question me all you want, but you ain't God. I am God. Do you think you have a better idea than I do? I'm the one that laid this whole thing out. I got the whole plan here. Where are you? Why do you dare question what I do? So we learn from this that no matter how much we fear God, how much we avoid evil, how much Satan takes away from us, how much pain and agony we go through in life, how much we are going to be persecuted, because Jesus even told us, you know, his disciples, that they will be persecuted. no matter how much we go through, the furthest from our minds should be questioning God on why. Why? Because He's God. He doesn't need any other answer, right? And when we learn that, we can have a lot more peace, can't we? That's when we can have that peace beyond understanding that the Bible talks about. Because we're no longer questioning God. We accept God. Precisely. Very good. Thank you, John. Anybody else? Questions? Answers? John, would you close us?